24-8080, United States v. Seminole.
Counsel for appellant, if you make your appearance and proceed, please.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Gail Johnson, and I represent Verdick Seminole in this direct appeal from his criminal convictions. I'm going to focus my comments today on the first claim, which is interrelated issues factually and legally, all touching upon the fundamental right under the Sixth Amendment to an impartial jury and a fair trial by an impartial jury. Of course, there's two aspects factually that lead up to this. The first is one juror violating repeated admonitions from the court not to discuss the case before deliberations when he's raised the issue of self-defense in the jury deliberations room while the trial evidence was still being presented. The second layer then is what happens next, which is that apparently two other jurors then had an ensuing conversation with an unknown number of individuals at the clerk's office. We don't know who those individuals were, we don't know how many, and we don't know what the content of that conversation was because the trial court failed to hold a Remmer hearing.
We do know that they worked in the clerk's office, right?
I think that's a fair inference from the record.
Okay, and the court, as in the district judge, instructed the jurors that if there were any concerns, that they should be brought to the attention of the court. How in the world are jurors going to do that, but not contact some court official to let that court official know that there was a concern? I mean, what other mechanism would there be, and how could one infer some misconduct from that? Two questions. Go ahead and answer that.
Yes, Your Honor. The other mechanism was the mechanism that the district court instructed the jurors to use, which was to submit a signed note if they needed to communicate with the court.
Okay, and let's assume there was a deviation from this stated mechanism. What could one infer as it relates to impropriety in that when the jurors spoke to a court official whose responsibility related to the district court judge? They didn't speak to a third party. They spoke to a court official.
Well, Your Honor, I think it's not the defendant's burden to show impropriety when that issue here is the lack of process in granting a Remmer hearing. When there may be prejudice from ex parte contact between...
Well, you use the word may be prejudice, and that leads to the question, what does it take to trigger a Remmer hearing? I mean, if the court can on its face see that there was no basis for prejudice as a matter of law, why would it need to conduct a Remmer hearing to pronounce again that there was no prejudice as a matter of law? I mean, it would seem that there would need to be some basis to believe, even if you assume, and I think this is predicated on the notion of hypothetically X, Y, and Z happen, even if those things happen, as a matter of law, they were not prejudicial, then why would the court need to conduct a Remmer hearing to validate that fact?
Because, Your Honor, we don't actually know what happened, nor did the district court, because the district court did not identify the individuals in the clerk's office and did not interview any of them. Did not interview either of the two jurors who went to the clerk's office and did not interview the original juror who committed the misconduct. None of those interviews. We have a record here where there was no inquiry whatsoever. So to say that, I think it's putting the cart before the horse in that situation to put a burden on the defendant to demonstrate prejudice. That's the whole point of a Remmer hearing, is for the defendant to have the opportunity to explore potential prejudice.
Well, counsel, can I ask about what I think is your probably bigger problem, which is after the district judge made a recitation for the record as to what was said in general terms from the employees of the clerk's office, he asked trial defense counsel and the prosecutor any questions or concerns, and they said, nope, no judge, good to go here. So you're saying, well, we don't have the burden to show prejudice, but this is on plain error. So have we ever had a case where we have found plain error for the failure to hold Remmer hearing?
Your Honor, I'm not aware of such a case, but I think given for that aspect of the claim regarding the ex parte contact that happened at the clerk's office, given that the remedy that is sought is an evidentiary hearing as opposed to vacating the convictions, for that aspect of the claim. I think on plain error review, it is reasonable to say that we need the process here. Otherwise, no, anytime a defense counsel forfeits but through negligence, asking for a REMA hearing, literally we would have these records where the worst possible jury contamination could have happened, but we're not going to know about it. Well, that can't be the law.
Well, but we do have cases, and McVeigh comes to mind, where we say a hearing doesn't have to be held if it would not be helpful or useful. And so here, again, we have a record. The district judge did make a record as to the communications and, you know, just laid it out there for counsel to raise concerns. I mean, it was kind of an obvious time for trial defense counsel maybe to step in. So I hear what you're saying about, the process and not having a record, so we don't know what we don't know. But on the other hand, a plain error, as you know, is a steep hill to climb. And so I guess I'm asking, how can we reverse just by saying, well, it was error not to hold a hearing, and that may have been plain, but once we get to prong three, I think it becomes a little more difficult. Can you address the prejudice aspect here?
Yes. The record that the district court made simply highlighted the lack of knowledge we have. For example, the plural term those is used about the original juror misconduct. So we know for sure, based on the record the district court made, that one of the topics discussed in the jury deliberation room before the trial was had ended, one of those topics was self-defense, which obviously goes to the core of this case. We don't know how many other topics there were. We don't know what the other topics were. To allow this conviction to stand without at least giving Mr. Seminole some process, a REMA hearing on remand, and again, I think the plain error standard should be applied differently when we're talking about a remedy of a remand for an evidentiary hearing as opposed to vacating the conviction. That's a different ask.
What's the foundation for that? I mean, I don't know any case where we've calibrated the plain error standard that way. And in fact, it would seem to me that when we're talking about an evidentiary hearing, going to the point, we don't know what we don't know. Well, whose fault is it that we don't know what we don't know? I mean, it's defense counsel for not raising the objection. And by not raising the objection, we're left in this place where there's a vacuum. And that vacuum invariably has got to cut against the defendant because the defendant didn't raise the objection. I mean, we can't, so what basis would we have? Because what we're talking about is reversal. We're saying there was a prejudicial, clear and obvious error here. What basis do we have to make such a statement when there is nothing to suggest that there's been harm?
Your Honor, my position is on the REMA claim. The basis for reversing is it was clear and obvious error not to grant a REMA hearing. Of course, yes, defense counsel is at fault. There is no doubt about that. That's why I raised this on plain error review. But given that the outcome of that REMA hearing is not automatically vacation of the conviction, I think that is a different inquiry for this court.
Let's talk about the raising of the issue of self-defense to begin with. Yes, that violated the court's instructions, but what about that suggests that there's some implicit bias against this defendant? I mean, the fact that self-defense was raised, it could have been raised in the sense of, boy, he had a good self-defense argument, didn't he? I mean, what about it? The categorical statement of self-defense, what about that suggests that there was some implicit bias against the defendant?
Your Honor, I think because it evidences irrefutably that juror violated 9 separate admonitions from the district court. That's irrefutable evidence that juror was either incapable or unwilling to follow the court's instructions. It doesn't get more basic than that in terms of implicating the defendant's Sixth Amendment right to a fair trial by an impartial jury.
Where's the through line between failure to follow instructions and implicit bias? Is that what we're talking about is whether there was bias by the juror against this particular defendant. And the fact that there was a difficulty of the juror in following instructions, how does that correlate to bias?
Well, Your Honor, I think it's more than a difficulty. I think, again, unwillingness or inability. And either of those just mean we can't trust that juror to follow instructions. But again, it's not just self-defense that was discussed in the jury room. Other plural topics were discussed. We don't even know what they are because no hearing was held.
Why can't we conclude that a hearing was held? I mean, the judge, on the record, made a recitation and teed it up, and then the parties did not request the taking of evidence. Why wasn't the REMA requirement complied with?
there's zero evidence in the record that a Remmer hearing was held.
Well, but again, when we say a hearing, you know, the parties are present, the defendant was present, a record was made as to the issue, and then the parties didn't want to present evidence. So that was their obligation. So why can't we look at the record here and say, well, there was a Remmer hearing. It was pretty short and cursory, but there was a hearing that was held.
You know, generally the way these hearings are held in the case law is that the district court is responsible for starting an inquiry. It's not that the parties are calling in witnesses. And let me also be clear, we of course have the implication of the defendant's right to be present. The defendant was not allowed to be, the defendant and his counsel were not allowed to be present when the conversation happened in the clerk's office, and defendant and his counsel were not allowed to be present when the conversation happened between the clerk's office and the court. And I see my time running down. I would also just quickly like to turn to the motion for mistrial regarding the out-courtroom outburst, which is a preserved issue. Very clearly, and the district court acknowledged that. And again, that outburst went to the core issue in this case of self-defense. I do want to emphasize factually for the court and highlight a couple pieces of evidence. During the testimony of Vanna Eagle, the 911 call was introduced. That's government's exhibit 1-2. It shows up in the conventionally submitted materials with a different number on them. I'm just going to give the court that as well, which is gov12_395. I believe it's the only audio file in there. It's clear in there within the first 30 seconds that Ms. Eagle tells the 911 operator, quote, "They are shooting at each other here at this house," unquote. And then another minute or so passes, and then she talks about other shots happening, and then clearly there's a lot of wailing, and that's when the decedent is shot. So she also knows what a misfire sounds like. So the decedent here had tried to shoot my client, had failed. She knows what a misfire sounds like. When she says they are shooting at each other, she must be referring to Mr. Vance. And that absolutely undermines the government's theory that Mr. Addison fired last. Of course, we have a cumulative error claim, too, because we have this jury instruction error on the initial aggressor problem, which this outburst goes directly to. So if the court doesn't have any questions on that, I'll reserve my remaining couple minutes for rebuttal. Thank you.
Good morning, and may it please the court.
Counsel.
My name is Christine Martins, and I represent the United States. Well, there's five issues this morning for the court's consideration. They relate really to three trial-level alleged errors, and the only preserved error is that outburst in the courtroom that counsel was just talking about. So I think I'd like to go there.
What is the test for when a Remmer hearing is required, Ms. Martin? I mean, what circumstance triggers the obligation to conduct a hearing?
Certainly, Your Honor. So a Remmer hearing is really only necessitated when you have exterior contact with the jury. This court and several, and I believe all the courts that I've looked at, break these jury misconduct and bias issues into two pieces: external things to the jury, outside influences, and intra-jury conduct. So we're really only in the zone of a Remmer hearing when we have those external contacts. And Remmer itself had to do with the offer of money in exchange for a juror member to deliver a certain verdict, which is certainly the kind of thing where a hearing should be held. On the other hand, we have those intra-jury function questions. And we've talked a little bit this morning already about McVeigh, and I think that that's a good case to illustrate this difference. So Timothy McVeigh bombed the Oklahoma City building, killed 168 people, and among those was the daycare, I think, that was on the first floor. It got enormous trial or publicity before trial and during trial. That defendant, in that environment, moved for a change of venue, and it was in that context that someone reported to the clerk's office that one juror said something along the lines of, gee, I hope I'm not the holdout. And another juror answers, well, we all know what the verdict should be. Now, in that case, the district court chose not to conduct a hearing where those jurors were pulled into the courtroom and interviewed, but instead made that recitation on the record and denied the motion for mistrial based on it. Now, this court in that case explained that the hearing was not required. It was up to the district court's discretion, and that discretion should be guided by the context and the credibility of the allegation and the seriousness of the allegation. And ultimately, in that case, this court said that the comments from the juror were actually ambiguous and didn't slice in terms of showing explicit bias against one party or the other. So certainly when we have this framework, here we have an intra-jury issue. There's no evidence of any kind of external contact with this jury. So we don't even
get...
That's
not what defendant's position is. The defendant, I spoke about the clerk's office being essentially an extension of the court. At least I didn't hear an acclamation to that point. So why isn't this an external contact?
This is not an external contact because we don't have anything of substance happening with the clerk's office.
How do we know that?
Because that's what the record reflects that we have, is that this is just a one-way ratchet, that the clerk received the report and funneled it along to the district court without any evidence in this record of any other contact.
Well, you heard the defense lawyer saying that the reason that we don't know whether anything else happened is because there wasn't a hearing. In other words, it becomes a cycle. I mean, we don't know it's a one-way ratchet. We don't know what they talked about in the clerk's office because the court chose not to have a hearing. So, I mean, why is it the logic of that persuasive?
I think that there are a couple of different reasons, Your Honor. So first and foremost, when the district court went on the record with the parties and defendant personally present, recited what happened and asked the parties what happened, and if they had questions or concerns about the proposed course of conduct, defense counsel said no. So to the extent that there is any issue with the record, we have explicitly declined to below develop that record. And that's why the government asserts that this claim is altogether waived. Defendant was specifically confronted with this problem and declined to take any further action. And on appeal, he wants further action. That the position is directly opposite. So, and I think that the lack of record here cuts against any claim of prejudice. And it shows that the record, well, I would submit is not ambiguous, but it is certainly in the sense that the court in McVeigh said, where that we can't divine from this record whether it cuts one way or another, and we shouldn't infer things that actually aren't in the record. I'll agree with Mr. Seminole that there are cases where court staff can be those external influences, but we're talking about things like a bailiff making a comment to a juror about what they think the outcome of the trial should be. Or the recent case, I think it was Demmer, that this court decided where an advertisement had been put up in the jury room.
Derman,
thank you. I misspoke. But certainly, Your Honor, you're familiar with the case, and those are external information. Actually, the court said in that case that the advertisement wasn't external because the investigation showed that it was a juror member who had taken it out of a magazine, so it was really an internal jury thing that had happened, but the concern was that it could be external because it was outside materials that were in that jury room along with some comments.
You spoke about McVeigh. When in looking at what the district court did there, did it draw or in any of these cases, do the district courts specifically draw the distinction between external and internal? In other words, when Judge Mates handled it the way he did, did he predicate it on the notion that it was an internal contact?
He didn't explain that logic on the record, but that distinction exists in the case law. And so I don't think there's any reason to think that the district court didn't have that distinction in mind in suggesting the course of action to the parties.
Well, counsel, can I ask, going back to McVeigh, though, as I recall in that opinion, when discussing the need for a hearing, the opinion says, on, quote, a rare occasion, a hearing need not be held. That tells me that the starting point is that there will be a hearing, and it's only on those rare occasions where it may not be useful or necessary where you don't have to have a hearing. And then, of course, we have other cases like Schism where there was communication directly with the judge between the juror, and I think it was either the courtroom deputy or the bailiff had brought concern to the court. And so I'm not sure this distinction matters as much in terms of whether it's communication outside or intra-court communication within the jury room. But I guess, can you address here, I hear Mr. Seminole's argument to be that once the district judge alerted the parties to this, sure, in an ideal world, trial defense counsel would have said we need to bring in the jurors individually and ask them about the communications. That didn't happen here, but the court has its own independent responsibility to make that record. And it didn't do that here. I mean, it does it minimally. And so, and that gets at what are core constitutional rights of the defendant. So can you address, I know that was, this is a long recitation, but I'm getting to the prejudice element here on plain error, prong three. How do we think about that in this context?
I think that this court should think about it both in terms of what the record looks like and what the record actually says. And what the record reflects happened is that someone made a comment about self-defense and the jury immediately shut it down, which is following the instructions given by the court in terms of not to discuss the case with anyone, including amongst themselves, until it's formally submitted with the charge for deliberations. And from the record, I don't think the court should infer anything but what the record actually says. And it's just a comment. It's just as likely that someone walked out of that courtroom into the jury room and said, whoa, self-defense is going to really be an issue when we deliberate, or something like that that's totally innocuous that got shut down, versus maybe expressing some sort of initial impressions of what the defendant's self-defense claim is. The record doesn't tell us what that is, but it does reflect that the jury immediately shut that conversation down. And then they followed their obligation to report it. And I disagree with Mr. Seminole's read of the record about that as well. What the record here reflects is that this jury panel was sworn in, introduced to the clerk, directed to go to the clerk to communicate issues to the court, and orally instructed to do so through a note. Shortly after that, the district court read the written instructions, talking about how you have the written instructions in front of you. Follow along. If there's any difference between oral instructions of the court and the written instructions carry the day. So when we go to the written instructions, what we find is that first charge, jury instruction number 5, talks about the importance of waiting to deliberate until the case has been formally submitted, the importance of ignoring all outside information, and then closes with, and if anything happens, contact the court, without specifying whether that should be in writing or verbally. Now, a couple of days go by before this happens, because this is, I believe, the close of the third day of trial, after Mr. Seminole testifies in his own defense as the 18th witness presented to this jury, with self-defense clearly a central issue in this trial the whole way. And I think it's perfectly reasonable at that point for that jury to go back to its written instructions and say, I think we're obligated to report to the court. Let's go talk to the clerk's office. And so again, I think that this record really shows that this jury was doing its very best to honor those instructions to the letter. And there's no reason to think that this jury would have done otherwise based on the record we have. And so when we're thinking about that prejudice, to really bring it back around to the heart of the question, there's nothing about the face of the record that reflects anything that would lead to the impression of prejudice against Mr. Seminole, that his rights were somehow violated, that this jury was somehow anything but impartial. And the court, in trying to figure out what to do, this court explained in McVeigh that there's a careful balancing act in choosing that course of conduct, whether or not to hold a hearing, that the court must also weigh the potential impacts of the hearing itself. Because remember, you're going to, mid-trial before the case is submitted, pull those jurors in, probably at least 3 of them, if not more, and talk to them about what's been going on and what was said, subjecting them to questioning at least directed by the court, if not also by the parties. So there's certainly a chance to leave impressions about the evidence and the proceedings at trial that might be adverse to either party, so that carries its own danger stopping the proceedings. And that's, Your Honors, why the district court behaved so reasonably here in reciting what happened and asking the parties if anything else needed to be done. And having declared that nothing further needed to be done below, Mr. Seminole can hardly now say more should have been done. If there are no further questions as to the jury misconduct question, I guess I would add one more thing on the communications with the clerk's office and that ratchet with the court. I was unable to find any case where that communication, that funneling of information, was singled out. And what you do find in the case law McVeigh, since we've been talking about that case, is the cases just recite, it was reported to the clerk, and then jump into the merits of the thing. So I think that this is also the normal mechanism that a jury would use to convey such a message. And as long as there's not sort of this implication that, say, the clerk's office told somebody something about what the verdict should be, that that's just the normal channel through which this information flows, and nothing should be inferred from that. So with that, if there are no further questions about that issue, Your Honors, I would touch on the motion for mistrial after the courtroom outburst, as that's the only preserved issue. So here, the district court immediately stopped the proceedings, immediately told the jury to disregard the outburst, excuse them from the courtroom, dealt with the motion for mistrial, citing this court's case law, and then when the court brought the jury panel back in, gave a fairly extensive instruction on the importance of disregarding that courtroom outburst. And the general rule when there is information in front of a jury, that is improper, is that that curative instruction is able to remedy any possible prejudice. And there's no reason to think that that's not the case here. So specifically below, the district court relied on the case United States versus Encinias. And while it's an unpublished opinion, it dealt directly with a courtroom outburst. In that case, which was a drug and gun trial, there was evidence that had been excluded before trial about a murder that had happened sort of in the mix of the events that were the subject of the trial. And during the trial, even despite the court's exclusionary order, reference had been made to the killing, and the decedent's mother from the gallery called the defendant a murderer. So in that case, this court said that the curative instruction was good enough. And then we would also point the court to Peralt, where we weigh the prejudicial impact of that improper information in light of the entire case. And central to the determination that improper information was not prejudicial there was the idea that the improper information hadn't occurred for the first time at that motion for mistrial. And here, Your Honors, as I mentioned before, Mr. Seminole was witness number 18 to testify in his own defense. I see I'm out of time. May I conclude my thought?
Finish your thought.
To testify in his own defense, and this was, while a central issue in the trial, it would have been no surprise to the jury that it would be hotly contested. And there's, again, no reason to think that this jury would not have followed those instructions. With that, Your Honor, we ask that the court affirm, save for the limited remand on the double jeopardy issue.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Thank you. On the Remmer issue, I just want to quickly just remind the court how McVeigh is so distinguishable. There it was clear that the court knew the content of the conversations, and there was a basis for the court to infer that the juror in question was following the court's instructions. In terms of the prejudice issue, I think I should have done a better job in my initial argument of saying that under Remmer, as modified by this court, that presumption of prejudice is a qualified presumption, and the defendant meets it simply by showing that the conversation in the jury room was about the case. That's not reasonably disputed here. So once that presumption of prejudice arises, a hearing needs to be held. In terms of this court's concerns about, well, gosh, can't we infer that because these were public officials, there's no impropriety. I just direct the court's attention to the U.S. Supreme Court's case in Parker and this court's decisions in Little and Rubenstein. Those are addressed in Mr. Seminole's opening brief, pages 23, 24, and his reply brief, pages 11 and 12, which all involve public servants and stand for the principle. I think the principle can arise from those cases that just because there's public servants involved in the ex parte contact with jurors doesn't mean no impropriety could occur. And finally, if I could briefly address the Encinias case on the motion for mistrial issue. To be clear, Encinias was a plain error review of that issue in that case because no motion for mistrial was made there. Here, of course, the issue was thoroughly preserved. And finally, with my remaining 22 seconds, I don't usually raise cumulative error issues in this court, but I have in this case. because it's interesting that all of, and important, I think, that all of the issues touch on the core issue of self-defense and whether or not Mr. Seminole was going to be convicted or acquitted. And so I think the court could also look again at the jury instruction issues and accumulate the prejudice when it does its plain error analysis. Thank you. We ask the court to reverse. And I know, again, the court, the government has conceded one of the convictions. Thank you.
Case is submitted. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.